Welcome back to The Takeaway after a long holiday weekend. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. On Wednesday, Black mamas, daddies, sons, and daughters across the country took a break from baking Thanksgiving pies, turned up their radios, held their breath, and listened.
Verdict is as follows. In the Superior Court of Glynn County, State of Georgia, the State of Georgia versus Travis McMichael, case number CR00433. Jury verdict form. Count one, malice murder. We, the jury, find the defendant, Travis McMichael, guilty.
And as Chatham County Superior Court Judge Timothy Wansley read the multiple guilty verdicts for Travis McMichael, Greg McMichael, and William Bryant, at least one Black father could not mask his response.
Guilty. I'm going to ask that whoever just made an outburst be removed from the court, please.
The judge removed Ahmaud Arbery's father, Marcus Arbery, from the courtroom, but that audible expression of relief was a response mirrored by so many who were holding absolutely still as we paused to listen. All three men involved with killing Ahmaud Arbery, guilty. Travis McMichael, the shooter, guilty on all nine counts. And these verdicts delivered by a nearly entirely white jury in a small Georgia town. Marcus Arbery was not alone in his response, because it was happening in kitchens and living rooms, workplaces, and cars across the nation.
Guilty.
Ahmaud's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, expressed her gratitude for the many who stood in solidarity with her family during the many months since her son was murdered on February 23rd, 2020.
I never thought this day would come, but God is good.
Yes, He is.
And I just want to tell everybody, thank you for those who marched, those who prayed, most of all the ones who prayed.
Yes, Lord.
Yes. Thank you, guys.
Yes, Lord.
Thank you. And now Quez, which you know him as Ahmaud, I know him as Quez.
Yes.
He will now rest in peace.
Yes. Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No verdict or sentence can bring life again to Ahmaud Arbery, but these unequivocal verdicts bring a measure of respite, a moment's reprieve in what has been a truly brutal decade of high-profile Black death, initiated back in February 2012 when George Zimmerman killed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin as Trayvon walked home with a bag of Skittles and an iced tea. Unlike the Florida jury that acquitted George Zimmerman, the Brunswick, Georgia jury insisted that those who murdered Ahmaud Arbery be held responsible. Joining me now is Nicole Lewis, senior editor of jurisprudence at Slate. Thank you for being with us today, Nicole.
Thanks for having me on.
So based on how you understand Georgia law, were these the right, technically correct, accurate verdicts?
Absolutely. So the prosecutor made an excellent case to say the defendants saying that they were arresting Ahmaud Arbery, that they were conducting a citizen's arrest, and that they shot him in self-defense, she basically destroyed their entire argument. And she made the case to say they didn't actually know if he had committed any crime or any felony in the moment that they were arresting him. All they knew that he was running down the street, and this is what they testified to. And so under Georgia law, you actually cannot conduct a citizen's arrest if you are not seeing someone carrying out a felony, if they haven't confessed to a felony. And so they pursued Ahmaud with no information. And that was really the crux of her case. And I think jurors bought it.
So underlying that for many Black observers was this notion that he must have been up to something illegal was also based on an understanding about race, that young Black men are themselves kind of inherently criminal. But that is not quite how the prosecution put it. I'm wondering how this prosecutor navigated conceptions of race given the jury.
So the jury actually didn't hear much in the way at all of any arguments about race and criminality and how racial animus might have led to this crime. You know, it was mostly absent during the entire trial. And I think it was a calculated move to say the jury is nearly all white. There is one Black person on this jury. And so how well are these arguments going to go over? And I think what became more important for the prosecutor to make was to say the McMichaels are testifying to say that they're conducting a lawful citizen's arrest, that they're acting in self-defense. And she said, That's not true. And they're testifying to that, right? To say they didn't actually know anything. All they saw was him running down the street at the time that they hopped in their trucks with their guns and pursued him. And you're not allowed to do that. When they called 911, which we have the tapes and we have the recording, so it was played in court, they didn't say anything about he was committing a crime, he had burglared a house, nothing of that sort. And so she was really able to make this case and undermine their arguments without having to wade into what could have been a really tricky or sort of difficult argument to make and for these jurors to buy.
So remind us of the defense strategy and why, at least in this case, it does not seem to have worked.
Their argument was that they were pursuing Ahmad as part of a lawful citizen's arrest, that they had information or suspected that he had been walking into a halfway built house, and they had some fears over rising crime in the neighborhood as well, and suspected that he might have been responsible for that. And that when the arrest went south, that they shot him in self-defense, that Travis McMichael shot him in self-defense. And so there's a couple reasons, again, why this doesn't work. For one, the prosecutor made very clear that in all of 2019, when she looked at the 911 calls, there was only one call for burglary, and it turned out to be a false alarm. So the information that the McMichaels had to say, crime is rising, there's a series of break-ins, we're so concerned, you know, wasn't true. That Travis McMichael testified that he had learned about concerns over crime from a Facebook group and from his mother. So they weren't fully based in reality. So that's one component. And then again, this other component to say that they had no information about whether or not Ahmad Arbery had committed a crime, and he hadn't, to be clear, that he had been seen on camera going into a house and walking around, but so had many other people. And it was also clear from that video footage inside the house that he had never taken anything. So there was no reason to suspect that he was guilty of any crime of stealing. And then in addition, they said, once we started the arrest and he didn't stop, that we became scared for our lives. You know, Travis McMichael says, I was afraid of being overpowered. I knew that if he tried to take my gun, he would shoot me and kill me. And so I had to act. And so, you know, it's when we stop and kind of pull back on that, I just think the fear defense is so interesting and thin, right? Consider that Ahmad was outnumbered. He was not armed. He'd been running for miles by the time this altercation happened. And so you just cannot buy the notion that, you know, they went in and now they're too scared and they had to shoot.
So I just want to pause on this. I think it does seem to me important. So these are three civilians. But if we were talking about three police officers, and if all of those police officers were heavily armed and there was one individual suspect and they suspected someone of a crime and they testified in court that they were afraid, that has been precisely how many members of law enforcement have not been held accountable based on how the law works relative to police officers.
Yes, and this is a common defense. We were afraid for our lives, and so we had to shoot. We thought this person had a gun, and so we had to shoot. They have a much different standard, right? So we protect police officers to say, we understand that your job is fairly dangerous. And so we're going to create some protections for you in case you injure someone, murder someone, hurt someone in the line of duty. And it's really important in the line of duty, right? So while they're, you know, on the job, sometimes other people are going to get hurt. And so there's a much higher bar for juries to clear to find police officers guilty when someone does die. And so we've seen this time and again throughout the past decade that police officers, you know, shoot unarmed Black people and get away with it for the most part. And so the Chauvin trial, I believe just earlier this year, right, was a moment in which the country again was holding its breath to say, you know, this wasn't a shooting. We actually watched a police officer kneel on someone's neck for so long. You know, where is the standard? Where is the limit? Can we actually find this person guilty of murder? And in this case, they did. Or in that case, they did.
So let's talk about what's next in the McMichaels case. So talk to me about sentencing. What's the timeline on that? And what do you expect to see?
So all men face, for all of the counts that they've been convicted of, they all face up to life in prison. And actually, I'm not sure when sentencing is happening. I believe currently this week, but not a specific date. And so, you know, this is something that the judge gets to weigh in to say what the appropriate sentence will be. But all men could spend the rest of their lives behind bars.
There's also the possibility of federal hate crime charges. They've all been indicted on these separate federal hate crime charges. What could those additional guilty verdicts mean if they were to be found guilty?
That's right. And so those trials have yet to happen. And so I believe February, they're coming up soon. And so, you know, this was critically important. I think in this case, in this trial, there was not much made in terms of argument in the courtroom about race and hatred and, you know, just what this crime represents in terms of the long legacy of racial violence in the South. And so with these federal hate crime charges, this is an opportunity for the country to really understand and look more closely at just exactly what happened in those streets. And so that's upcoming. At this point, I'm not so sure in terms of what difference it makes if they're convicted of life in prison. They'll spend the rest of their lives in a state prison, even if they are convicted of a federal crime.
But that federal hate crime, we're going to expect, in part because obviously it's a hate crime trial, we're going to expect to hear these conversations about race and about history in a way that's been quite different from what we've heard in the state case.
Absolutely. So the state case was mostly about this question of citizens' arrest and rising crime and right self-defense. And so the federal case will squarely put the question of, were the Mike Michaels, motivated by racial animus, hatred for Black people? Did they pursue Ahmaud Arbery specifically because the color of his skin? You know, did they use a racial slur? All of those things will be front and center in this federal case.
And then there's one other person who is charged here, and that is the former district attorney, Jackie Johnson, charged with mishandling the case. I'm wondering what we know about that, and if that is likely to affect the case that Johnson's facing.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, she is charged with basically obstructing justice and, you know, not allowing this case to go forward. And so I think, you know, just taking it back to the top of the story to hear those audible sighs of relief, I think it's important to point out that for many months after the McMichael shot and killed Ahmaud Arbery, they walked free, right? And so there were so many people who were thinking, we may never see justice in this case because look at how these men were treated from the beginning. And so Jackie Johnson being directly responsible for that, ultimately recusing herself, but now being indicted herself, that she, you know, prevented the police from intervening, the police from arresting them that day, misled prosecutors and basically said that she wasn't going to press charges in this case. And so, yeah, it remains to be seen. But, you know, three guilty verdicts doesn't look good for her.
Nicole Lewis, senior editor of Jurisprudence at Slate, thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thanks for having me on.